Then why do you tell us of the ant invasion?
Because I am ant people.
Ant people, baby, Julie Bennett.
Bambino mio, bambino, io ti vedo. This is Pasquale Face behind us now. Tu skein di dal le stelle pastoral di Natal. We heard Julie Benac performing before the Hoofenmouth Sinfonia along with X-Ray Burns back at the 2012 WFMU Marathon Finale in Maxwell's. That was Adam and the Ants Invasion. Skip and Gale from a numero comp called Barnyard Beehive doing That's All I Want From You. Jack and Ellsworth from Six Static Scenes gave us scene three after Dink Roberts. Mark Weber, great lost CD from about 22 years ago. Oki Musique Concrète, Starting Point Overture is what we heard. We heard Audie Gelbart doing Defier Ascension from Liquids and Flesh. Shackleton and Six Organs of Admittance with the Grip of the Flesh. Oh boy, a lot of music from Jinxed by Being. A box set from To Live and Shave in L.A. The Wig Maker in 18th Century Williamsburg. We heard The Rose, The Vehicle of Miss High Heels. Nancy Richmond and the Mood Elevators did Buttermilk Dreams. Sloppy Heads, by the way, Sloppy Summer has commenced. They are doing their monthly residency at Mama Tried. I look them up. I forget when. It's once a month. The first one has happened, I think, last week. Between Pitches is what we heard. We heard Serpent Power going out to listener Ziggy, who I met over the weekend. Up and Down, the name of the track from Serpent Power. We heard Norma Taniga at the top of the set. What More in This World Can Anyone Be Living For? Version 2 from I Don't Think It Will Hurt If You Smile. This is Freeform Radio, WFMU in East Orange, WMFU in Mount Hope in New York City, and Rockland County at 91.9 FM. Worldwide online at WFMU.org. My name is Scott, and I look forward to seeing you next week. You sit tight right now because Mark Hurst is here. Tectonic is next.
Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst, I'll be your host for the next hour. Thanks so much for joining. We're going to be talking about a recent development in surveillance with a repeat guest, a friend of the show, Dr. Chris Gilliard is on the show. I'm going to be running this interview here in a couple of minutes. Chris has been on the show a couple of times. You can find his past appearances in the archives if you go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm. And today, Chris is going to be talking with me about something that came to light in the last week or two from Facebook Meta, which has these surveillance glasses out on the market. I don't know if you've seen these, but they look like Ray-Ban glasses. They have the Ray-Ban logo on them. And if you look very carefully, you might notice that there are two surveillance cameras on the glasses. I think it's two. And the idea of these surveillance glasses is that, as Facebook Meta puts it, you can record something going on around you and it will upload it to your Facebook account. But of course, Facebook has its own ulterior motive for moving these into the market, which is to gain more data on all of us, which is the case with many big tech companies, not just Facebook. But the development with these spyglasses is that Facebook is now going to be adding facial recognition as a feature to the spyglasses, which is going to change all sorts of things in public and not for the better. I'm going to be talking to Chris Gilliard about that development. And then, as you'll hear, the conversation moves on to a larger discussion about surveillance, and in particular, Chris's notion of what he calls luxury surveillance, which he's going to explain. And we'll finish by talking about what this all means. So we're going to start narrow with the development with the Zuck specs, and then we're going to move out broad. I really enjoyed this conversation with Chris, and I think you will too. If you would like links to the items that I'm going to bring up after the interview and other information on the show, go to tectonic.fm, tectonic.fm, and the playlist for this show is right there on the page. Just look up the playlist for the Chris Gilliard episode. Let's go ahead now and listen to my interview with Chris Gilliard here on Tectonic. Chris Gilliard, welcome back to Tectonic.
Oh, thanks, Mark. It's always great to be here.
It is great to have you back on the show, Chris. For listeners who don't know who you are, you've been on the show a number of times over the years, most recently in February, and you're a friend of the show. I'm always happy to have you back with us. You're a surveillance scholar, and you're working on a book for MIT Press called Luxury Surveillance, How Big Tech Sells Us the Pleasure of Being Watched. And I hope we'll be able to talk a little bit about your concept and this phrase that you've coined, luxury surveillance. First, Chris, I just wanted to bring up a news story. The story is about the Facebook surveillance glasses. As you well know, Facebook came out with these spy glasses housed in frames made by Ray-Ban. They allow users to record audio and video around them. The idea was that they would send the footage up to Facebook. What is going on with the Facebook surveillance glasses that people should know about, Chris?
Oh, where to begin? I mean, I guess what I would first say is I look finally back upon the glasshole era.
This is from Google Glass back in 2013 when Google launched their initial surveillance glass headset.
Yes, and society proved that we were still capable of rejecting things that were antisocial, rejecting technologies that were antisocial.
I remember those that golden era, Chris.
When people
the good old days when people were able to say, no, we don't want creepy dystopian tech in society.
Yeah, I mean, and so that ability to say no is an interesting, I think, entry point to talk about this, because Zuckerberg and his career, or Facebook since its inception, has been an anti-consent machine in a lot of ways. And I think that this iteration of these glasses is just another example of that, unfortunately. And so apparently they'll have something, I don't know what they call it, something like they call it super sensing mode or something like that, which as part of the project will have face recognition.
Okay, I think this is one of the biggest news headlines of the year, and it's not getting a whole lot of attention. The Facebook surveillance glasses were bad enough that people can be in public and they can be recorded with their image, their actions, their words sent straight up into the Facebook cloud without their knowledge or consent. But this is a whole other layer of dystopia when people with the surveillance glasses can identify you in public, again, without your knowledge or consent. They can see through their little digital readout exactly who you are and associated information about you.
Yeah. And if you recall, there are these two young people from, I think, Harvard, who did some kind of mock-up of this a few months ago. And they received a lot of attention for it. Their claim was that they did it as sort of a warning. You notice I say that that was their claim. I'm not particularly inclined to accept that. But their claim that was that they did it as a warning. At the time when journalists talked to Facebook about it, you know, notably, I think Joseph Cox from 404, whatever Facebook spokesperson they talked to, was pretty prickly about the suggestion that they were at some point going to incorporate facial recognition.
How dare you suggest?
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that Facebook would actually intend to add dystopian surveillance features to our spyglasses?
Yeah. But lo and behold, and I think this goes along again with how Facebook / Meta often introduces products, right? They kind of give lip service to the idea of consent and listening to communities and things like that, you know, sort of float trial balloons up to see how vociferous people will be in their rejection of these things. And then they do it anyway. I mean, we've seen this time and again. But I think it's important, again, to talk about just how antisocial this is.
Yeah.
So a concept that I think about often, Woody Herzog and Evan Selinger talk about this idea of obscurity. And what that means, and it's not exactly the same as privacy. What that means, though, is that generally in society, a good aspect of society is that as a person going about your day, that you can conduct your business without being bothered, right? Without being harassed, without being identified, without being connected to other people that you don't want to connect to. And that in a sort of functioning society, this is an important opportunity for us, or it's an important way of being. That if I want to go get a coffee or go have lunch, or if I'm going to the doctor, or if I'm going to church, or if I'm taking a walk in the park, that I'm able to do these things without being harassed. And this has nothing to do with whether or not you are doing anything wrong or doing anything offensive or anything like that. It's just that as a person who has some rights and personal space, that you should be able to go about your business. These glasses, and I think there are a lot of technologies that threaten to do this, but specifically these glasses, in this case, they run the risk of eroding that notion or that possibility of obscurity in some ways, I think, that are very dangerous, particularly in the direction that society is going now. So one of the objections I can anticipate is that people will say, well, you could already do some of these things. You could take out your phone. You could film people. You can run that through some commercial facial recognition product that's available online and things like that. And this is all true. But what these glasses threaten to do is reduce all the friction associated with that process and also make it very easy for you to do these things surreptitiously, that you could go into a restaurant or a bar or a locker room or, again, a church. I mean, any setting where you can imagine that you could go and identify people who don't really have a choice in whether or not they want to be identified. And I think that's very, potentially very damaging to the social fabric.
I completely agree. In that Harvard experiment, those two Harvard students you mentioned from a few months ago, they posted a video of going into the subway, which in Boston is called the T stop, somewhere in Boston or Cambridge, and approaching people and saying, "Hey, isn't your name Joe Blow?" And the person says, "Yes," and they look surprised. "Oh, how did you recognize me?" And they said, "Didn't you write the book so-and-so?" I mean, I guess they were coming across professors or authors or whatever in the T-stop. And the person would say, "Yes." And they said, "Oh, I'm just a big fan of your work." And the person seems flattered, but a little bit confused how these random kids would have known their scholarly work. If you then apply that to everybody all the time, the reality, just as you say, Chris, the reality of then going out in public or going to a store, a restaurant, a church, or I would add a meeting of people organizing for a dissent allows you to be immediately identified and tracked. Again, without your knowledge or consent, that someone with the ease of tapping a hidden button on some glasses immediately has that power over you because they know who you are, they know what you've done professionally, and they can then get access to your socials, anything that's publicly available about you, which is a lot these days. And so all possibility of anonymity, or as you say, obscurity, evaporates as soon as these glasses come out. The other thing that I would add, Chris, is that in the video of the Harvard students, they were clearly working with a kludgy system that they had spent some time putting together. They had to take the images from the Facebook surveillance glasses and run them through, I think it was through Instagram, and then take a filter from Instagram and run it through PIM Eyes, which is this reverse image search, and then feed it back to a dashboard. I mean, it was a several step process, you know. So if someone really wants to go to all that trouble, then this is what they can do. When this changes to being a built-in feature of Facebook's surveillance glasses, it comes with an implicit assurance almost that this is socially acceptable, because Facebook, one of the richest and most powerful companies in the world, has added this to their glasses. And so people will think it must be okay because Facebook is providing this to us.
Yeah, absolutely. The other thing I didn't mention is this is has the potential to join the AirTag as a stalker's favorite tool. The risk to people's privacy in terms of their ability to avoid harassment is immense. It's so incredibly irresponsible and dangerous to put this product out, you know. But I think that, and this is something certainly you've talked about on your show quite a bit, that these companies, and I'm including Meta, but we could talk about some of the other things that the larger tech companies have done with AI and other things. They've really felt emboldened by the current administration to indulge in some of their worst and most antisocial projects, because they've seen that there is not going to be much done by the government to protect consumers, citizens, you know, people walking down the street. And so this is a really disturbing indication of what companies think they can now get away with.
I see there being two parallel impulses here. One is the companies figure accurately that they can get away with more because there are fewer checks, fewer guardrails now than there were with the previous administration. At the same time, even further than that, the companies see that the current occupant of the White House may draw on this material. I did a show not long ago about the kidnapping of Rumeyza Ozturk, the Tufts grad student who was disappeared. Finally, she's been returned, thank goodness. But apparently the administration found her through the use of an AI algorithm that scoured the public web and found an old op-ed that she had co-authored for the Tufts student newspaper a year previously. It flagged her due to whatever the AI surveillance algorithm was looking for. So when we have surveillance glasses like Mark Zuckerberg's conducting facial rec on everybody in the vicinity of whoever's wearing these glasses. Zuckerberg, who I will add was happily standing right by the podium at the inauguration, aligning himself with the current occupant, Zuckerberg knows that he may be called on to serve up some of that surveillance information for the current occupant's purposes.
Yeah, and I'll add another layer. I mean, depending on which system they use, there are many companies who have some sort of algorithm, you know, recognition algorithm that claim the ability to detect race, to detect gender, to detect ethnicity, to detect whether or not you're trans or gay. Now, I say that they claim the ability to do these things. A computer cannot tell your gender, and it doesn't matter what the company says in that regard. Like, it's actually not possible, because that's not something a computer is able to do. But whether or not it can do those things, it gains the weight of the authority of the technology when it's deployed. And so what I mean by that is people in power who are going to use these systems to target people do not actually care that the system cannot tell someone's gender, that the weight of the bias built in the machine and the weight of the authority of the technology is going to cause people to act as if it can. I mean, we've seen this countless times with facial recognition where, you know, as I point out often, I live in Detroit, and there are several cases of misidentification of facial recognition where people were caught up into the carceral system based on the assertions, you know, of a machine. In one case, the guy looked at a photo that was not him, says, "It's not me." And the police officer said, "Oh, so I suppose the computer is wrong." Computer was wrong, but, you know, there's this automation bias that a lot of privacy and surveillance scholars talk about. The extent to which people will believe a judgment, you know, it's not even right to call it a judgment, that people will believe an output by a machine just because it's automated, just because it's a machine. And so, again, I hate to go down a dystopian trail, but these are all things that are possible, unfortunately. You know, I think more and more, one of the ways I think about a lot of these technologies, particularly with some of the technologies that people call artificial intelligence and algorithms, is that in many ways they serve as sort of permission slips, in that they give institutions and authorities a rationale or permission to do things that they were completely invested in doing anyway.
Well, part of what's at work, I think, Chris, in the growing popularity of Facebook's spy glasses is people like the idea of having the latest and greatest technology from Silicon Valley on their wrists, on their faces, or on their ring fingers, wherever they're going to put these devices. And so often these devices are spreading this culture of surveillance. And so a couple of years ago, you coined this term luxury surveillance. And as I said at the beginning of the interview, you're working on a book for MIT Press called Luxury Surveillance. So can you give us a little overview of what is luxury surveillance and how does that play into what we see happening with Zuckerberg's surveillance glasses?
Yeah, absolutely. So a lot of the ways that people talk about surveillance, and I mean, I'm included in this, is often something that is deployed upon people who have little or no say on whether or not they're going to be surveilled. So a classic case is something like an ankle monitor, that most often the people who are given or supplied an ankle monitor to wear are not given the choice to wear it. Or the choice will be something like, well, you can stay incarcerated in an actual prison, or you can wear this ankle monitor and be imprisoned in your home. Some choice like that. So often that there's sort of a top-down model of surveillance. But I think that there's another way to think about these technologies that's important, that helps kind of flesh out where we find ourselves in the present moment. And that's why I started to talk about things in terms of luxury surveillance. And so I think about that in terms of surveillance that people adopt as opposed to surveillance that's imposed. Surveillance that people adopt for their own uses, or which they assume that there'll be some benefit derived, but also that, again, are devices whose primary technological purpose is to surveil them. So these are things like smart doorbells, smart rings, smart glasses. You know, like I don't really think of these things as smart, but I'm trying to avoid brand names. But watches, pendants now that record you, even systems in people's cars now. And that often the people who adopt these things think about the benefits that they may accrue, but don't think about the aspects of control that are part of these devices. And so one way or one example, or how I often encourage people to think about this is, why are companies so invested in having you have a device on your face or on your wrist or on your finger, or this new sort of wave of devices that are always recording? Now, part of it is that almost every company you can think of is some conglomeration of data extraction schemes. I mean, I joke that Facebook or Meta is just a dozen data extraction schemes in a trench coat. What companies really need from us is for us to continually supply them with data. Now, a phone does this, and most of us now carry phones. But the problem, at least from the company standpoint, is that sometimes the phone is in your pocket or your bag or your purse. And so there's a limit to the amount of data that it's extracting. But if you have a thing on your face or your wrist or your finger, then it's constant. You are constantly being extracted from, sometimes even when you sleep, based on what the device is. You know, I read a book a couple months ago called The Ordinal Society that really stood out to me. One of the points they make is that what tech companies need from us is that we are bodies that are constantly supplying data. That a productive person, in terms of a consumer, is someone who is constantly supplying data. One of the best ways for us to be productive in the minds of tech companies is that we wear devices on our body. You know, I call these things luxury surveillance. The goal of these companies is to force you to make your interior your exterior. They want insight into your interior processes, right? Whether that's your biometrics, you know, your heart rate, your blood pressure, you know, things like that, your blood sugar, maybe, but also your interior thoughts, your inner monologue, you know, whatever that looks like to you. This is sort of the goal with a lot of the AI systems, but also the things that they're constantly reading your body's data, is to render your interior into your exterior. So that's a long-winded way to say this is how I think about luxury surveillance and part of what the book is about.
And we're back. If you were just tuning in, you were listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'm your host. We are halfway through my interview with surveillance scholar Chris Gilliard. As you heard, we started the interview by talking about Facebook's new upcoming feature for their spy glasses, in which wearers will be able to activate facial recognition on the people surrounding those glasses, and that's going to change the experience of being in public forever, and not for the better. And as promised, we have widened the conversation beyond those Zuck specs into this idea of luxury surveillance, the phrase that Chris Gilliard has coined. And I'm going to start the second half of the interview with a pointed question to Chris that some of you may have in mind as we're talking about some of these surveillance devices. If you want more information on the show, go to tectonic.fm, TECH tonic.fm, and click the playlist link for the Chris Gilliard Show. Let's go ahead now and listen to the second half of my interview with Chris Gilliard here on Tectonic. Well, some people hearing this, Chris, will say, I completely agree what Chris is saying about being aware of what the companies want. They want me to serve as a source of data for their extraction schemes. But the smart ring, or what I would call surveillance ring, the smart ring that I wear on my finger assures me, the company behind it assures me that all of my data is encrypted and it's not shared with anybody. It's purely for my benefit. What do you say to this response, Chris, that actually there are some companies that are the good guys that aren't actually trying to simply extract data? They are keeping the data safe without sharing it.
I mean, when I finish laughing, if someone says that to me, after I finish laughing, yeah, I point out a couple things. Companies cannot guarantee this. They are constantly hacked, breached. Employees are looking at the data. The terms of service and the EULAs are constantly changing. Companies are bought. They go out of business. They're acquired by someone else. You know, governments can often ask for or demand this information. I mean, we could go on, but there is no company who makes these kinds of devices who has earned the benefit of the doubt in terms of protecting user data. They do not exist. You can go down the list. I'm not going to say explicitly the name because I'm not directly quoting. But maybe in the show notes we can put the article. But one of the prominent companies that makes a surveillance ring, someone asked him if the company would hand over data to the government to indicate when women might be pregnant. And he said his answer was something along the lines of, well, I don't know of any government that would really ask for that information. Like, it wasn't like a thing that had occurred to him. Okay. Now, right. So not only are they not in a position to make promises, but they're not in tune with the pressures and threats that many of us face day in and day out. And so I think if you have customers who are Americans who might be pregnant, you probably should be thinking about what you will do if authorities come and ask for that information. I mean, I think that would be a prudent thing to do if you sell a device that has anything to do with fertility. But these companies often don't think about the people who use their products in this way.
Well, it's possible that they're not thinking about it. The other possibility, of course, is that they're well aware of
right.
the current occupant's obvious interest in getting that data, and he's simply playing dumb.
Yeah, that's also a possibility. I mean, I you gave an actual less optimistic reading than I did, which that often isn't possible. So congratulations. I applaud you on that. So a lot of the benefits that these companies assert are far overblown. But the other thing is, you know, and I say this too with in terms of people who, for some reason or another, feel that they need security cameras. It's possible to have some of these things in ways that don't primarily serve the company. You know, but we have been, you know, victimized isn't the right word, but it's a word that fits, you know. But we've been victimized by a decades-long campaign by these companies that say that the only way to have devices where you get any benefit is that we get to surveil you constantly. It doesn't have to be this way. It is not necessarily how those things work. You know, there are different ways of formulating technologies. Like, I don't use these devices, okay? But for people who do or think that they must, I would say that there is a world where we could have some of these things, but that don't serve the companies. You know, you mentioned earlier about the way that a lot of these CEOs were lined up at the inauguration, there's a couple different ways you can look at that. But part of what I think what that signaled to me is their alignment with some severely authoritarian impulses. These companies are in no way our friends or friends of democracy. I think that that's important to reckon with when we use these technologies.
Totally agree. And that's before we even get to more, let's say, benign but inevitable ways that data can be spread around. As you said before, if your data is with one of these companies and they get sold. I mean, what comes to mind is what happened recently with 23andMe. For years, I was telling people, don't swab your cheek. Don't send your DNA to some Silicon Valley company. And people would say, no, no, they assure me that my data is safe. And now it's up for grabs. And the other thing I want to point out, Chris, is even if the data was safe, as you said, you still got to ask, why do you need this thing on your wrist, on your finger? I had a friend recently who wears one of these surveillance devices, I don't know, a wrist, a ring, something like that. He happened to tell me, my surveillance device tells me that I got a great night of sleep last night. And I said to him, how do you think humanity for our first 500,000 years was able to survive and analyze our own sleep patterns in the morning before we had this helpful device that gave us a readout? Is there any other way you think you might be able to detect your quality of sleep? It's, as you say, the companies have had this long campaign that the only way to get anything done now is by sharing all of your data with them, the companies, and then they'll give you a tiny little dribble of information back in the same way that surveillance cameras first have to hand over all of their footage to, let's say, Amazon or Google, and then they'll allow you to see what happened. At some point, Chris, at some point, do you think there could be a shift where we do have some options where we're actually getting technology that works for our benefit rather than primarily benefiting these extractive companies?
You know, that's an interesting question. I'm not prone to optimism, but I will say I hope so. And part of why I say that is I think that companies have begun to overplay their hand. And what I mean by that is they used to hide some of their more pernicious and offensive practices. They didn't used to be so explicit that they were constantly mining you for data, that they viewed you as a bag of flesh that constantly is extruding information, you know, that they use to their benefit. They used to be a little bit coy about that. More and more they are not. And we could talk too about the ways that large language models and chatbots sort of play into this equation as well. But companies are really explicit about these things now because they do not think that we have a choice. And so they have begun to be very explicit. Let me use an example. So there's been a lot of information coming out about Google and their search engine lately. There's a trial, I guess, with the potential that Google may have to break off their browser or their search engine as part of the ruling. So the information that's come out, you know, and I think anecdotally people have known this, but there's a Google official who openly articulated that Google search has been degraded with the onset, the introduction of AI into their product, that Google doesn't work as well as it used to. Google knows this. They know that their product has been degraded, but they don't care because we have so few options. And they have calculated that you'll spend more time on a degraded product than if you just got the answer and went to the website.
Which makes them more money because it drives engagement.
Right.
Wait, let me get this right, guys. You can imagine the board meeting. You're telling me, if we make Google search worse, they're going to stay on Google longer and we're going to make more money?
Right. It's genius, right? Yeah. And so I think that this is paradigmatic, right? Like, I think it provides us an example for how these companies overall are operating now. By and large, we are understood to not have a choice. And so how they treat us as, you know, I don't like this term, but like how they treat us as users or consumers is that they're not that concerned with our experience because we don't have choices. Now, my preferred belief, though, is that they're overplaying their hand and that a time will come sooner rather than later where we do have choices and that rejecting some of these systems becomes easier and more likely.
I hope you're right, Chris. But if I can just throw in one more depressing layer into this, it just seems to me like one of the benefits to Silicon Valley of the current environment is that people are left overwhelmed. They feel so overloaded. You know, whether they're swiping through TikTok all day or a scarily large percentage of Americans get their news primarily from Facebook. So they're overloaded with whatever sludge Facebook is sending to them. And in my experience, informally talking to people, if I tell them, you know, the topics that I cover on this show and what I'm concerned about in terms of big tech and surveillance and everything, they'll say, yeah, I agree with you, but there's nothing I can do about it. And there are so many other things happening in the world that I feel powerless. I mean, essentially, the attitude is people feel paralyzed because of the sheer onslaught of the sludge that big tech is sending at them every day. And that obviously is to Silicon Valley's advantage, to keep people feeling disempowered and paralyzed. And so they're more likely just to go back to their slot machine game because everything is too much already and there's nothing I can do about it. What do you think is possible for society to snap out of that or take a step forward? What can we do to encourage people to exercise some of their agency to start resisting what's happening?
Yeah. Well, the first thing I would say is that feeling is by design. And it's not only tech companies, right? I think that there are large segments of institutional power dedicated to making us feel this way. I am not one who says, you know, who centers our power in the form of our consumerism, you know, so I'm not going to say like, you know, don't have a phone or whatever. But I think that there are some attitudes we can first have, right, that will start to shift us away from this sort of nihilism. And, you know, I'm not gonna lie, it's like, it looks very dark right now. But understanding that there are, and I mean, this sounds like really shadowy and secretive and conspiratorial, but that said, I mean, that there are powerful companies and very rich individuals who have spent a tremendous amount of money trying to make us feel that this is the case, you know, that we have no choices, that these things are inevitable, that the only thing to do is take it. But that's never been the case. And it's not now. You know, I think that there are some ways to find solidarity with people that are like-minded. And I think that there needs to be different levels of sort of resistance, right? That's going to need to come from, say, organized labor. That's going to need to come from politics. That is going to need to leverage people's consumer power. But I don't think any of these things can be done in isolation. And I use that word intentionally because I think most of all, what the project is to make us feel isolated. And so that we do feel powerless, right? And that, again, this could be a whole nother show, but I think the introduction of bots that they say can be your friend or your romantic partner or your therapist or your doctor or your teacher, right, is also part of this thing, right, which is to isolate us, to silo us, and to make tech companies the intermediary between us and any form of enjoyment or social interaction that we have. And so, you know, again, some of this is cliched, but like, for instance, when people say, well, like, if I am going to have a package delivered and I'm not going to be home, like, this is why I have to have a doorbell camera. And it's like, no, like, you could actually ask your neighbor to look out for it. Right. I mean, you could have it delivered on the weekend. Like, you could, I mean, there are so many other ways that we can operate that involve community that do not necessitate lives mediated by these things. You know, I mean, when you were joking about how did people survive without these things, I mean, in some ways they got along quite well. I mean, there are others ways in which they didn't, but, and yeah, in some ways people got along quite well. And so, you know, it's difficult because I know that probably when I say things like this, sometimes it sounds very tinfoil hat, but a lot of the project of many of the current technologies is invested in making us feel isolated, and removed from actions that have us invested in our communities. And so that's one of the ways that I think we need to start thinking about how to do things differently.
I like that idea. Reaching out and establishing relationships and growing connections within your own community, that's a real act of resistance against these forces from big tech and others. I have one other tip for listeners, which I've given them before. If anybody is on Blue Sky, they can and should subscribe to your feed, Chris, which is at Hypervisible. That's where I get a lot of my dystopian tech news. So it's a essential part of my media diet and a way to keep in touch with what you're working on. In addition to Hypervisible, Chris, is there anything else we should be reading or watching or subscribing to, either from you or from someone else along these lines?
Well, Alex Hanna and Emily Bender just came out with their new book, The AI Con. You know, I'm a pretty consistent reader of Brian Merchant's work. And I'm missing some people, but those are the ones who come to mind right now.
Well, Brian Merchant was recently on the show, so people can go in the archives to listen to my interview of him about his book, Blood in the Machine. And Emily and Alex are going to be on the show soon talking about the AI Con.
Oh, fantastic. And yeah, I mean, my book won't be out for a while, but keep an eye out for the term luxury surveillance.
Chris Gilliard, it is always a pleasure and a privilege to have you on the show. Thanks so much for coming back on, and I'm looking forward to our next chat.
Oh, yeah, anytime. It's one of my favorite things to do, so I appreciate it.
And we're back. If you are just tuning in, you're listening to Tectonic. My name is Mark Hurst. I'll be your host for the remaining 15-ish minutes of the show. We just heard my interview with surveillance scholar and friend of Tectonic, Chris Gilliard, talking about his term luxury surveillance and how it applies to Facebook's upcoming feature in their Ray-Ban surveillance glasses of facial recognition. And I really think, as Chris and I were talking about in this interview, this story, which was broken by a site called The Information and then reported on by Joseph Cox and 404 Media, this story, I think, is one of the biggest of the year, because if and when facial recognition becomes common in a consumer device like Zuckerberg's surveillance glasses, all privacy goes away anywhere outside of your home. As Chris said, it's if you're walking on the street, of course, or if you're riding public transportation, of course, but it's also when you're indoors and other places. When you go to a restaurant, you can be identified, and all of your associated information that's available on the public web, which is quite a bit, thanks to the unregulated data brokers and the big tech surveillance capitalists like Facebook itself, all of that information is available to whoever is wearing the surveillance glasses from Facebook. And it's not just restaurants or bars. You go to church, go to or any other religious situation, you can be identified by someone who comes in wearing those surveillance glasses. If you go to any meeting that's been organized for some political party that wants to express dissent, or even not a political party, just a group of friends who want to somehow discuss dissenting ideas that differ from the current administration, you can be identified and recorded. And all of that footage, your audio, your video, and all of your identifying information can then be shared with any agency that has the money that wants to buy it from Facebook or data broker. I mean, this changes everything. And people are they're just not talking about this total destruction of our privacy that is coming down the pike if this becomes common. Now, there's nothing I can say on this show that is going to move the market one way or the other, but I can say that for myself, I have stopped buying Ray-Bans. I used to like Ray-Ban sunglasses. They worked pretty well, and they were just kind of a middle-of-the-road option, but I was actually in the market for some new sunglasses recently, and I thought to myself, I cannot buy Ray-Ban. That's the one brand I cannot buy because I don't want to be somewhere in public, and once these things become common, I don't want anyone wondering if I have the Zuckerberg surveillance specs on. Because it's hard to distinguish the Zuck specs from the non-surveillance Ray-Bans. They look almost exactly alike. So, I don't know. My two cents is that you shouldn't buy Ray-Bans anymore. just to be polite to people, so you can signal to them, I am not surveilling you. Just any other brand. For now. I'm sure at some point, if we continue this dystopian slide, there will be other brands. But I did like what Chris said, that there is hope. It is not all doom and gloom. There is hope. It's going to require a concerted effort from at least three groups. Chris mentioned organized labor, politics / legislation, and consumer power. So whether you're organizing a union, whether you are writing letters to your elected officials, or whether you are making better choices for yourself, your family, and recommending to friends and colleagues what to buy, what not to buy, all of those efforts can make a difference if we work together. We can work together to get a regulated environment where workers actually have some rights and consumers are finally given some options and are making better choices with their purchases. And I'm going to continue to talk about these options on this show because I firmly believe that there is a way forward for us. We have to both acknowledge what's going wrong and the harms that Zuckerberg and the other big tech CEOs are bringing to all of us, but also to point out hope that there is a way forward. And I really appreciate Chris being on the show and giving us some of that hope. With that said, I will end by bringing up just a couple of stories that have hit the news recently. And these, by the way, are all linked on the playlist, which you can get to at tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm, and click the playlist link for the Chris Gilliard Show. One of them just came out from the Washington Post. I put a gift link there so you can get past the paywall. I will acknowledge that the Washington Post is owned by a big tech billionaire, that is Jeff Bezos, but this particular article has nothing to do with Bezos or Amazon or whatever. The headline is, Police Secretly Monitored New Orleans with Facial Recognition Cameras. And that stuck out to me because part of my childhood, I grew up, adolescence I should say, I grew up in New Orleans, so I feel some some affection, of course, still for that city, and I hope it continues to do well. But I'm sorry to see that, according to this news from the Washington Post, the police were using a network of maybe 200 cameras that were illegally bringing about facial recognition on everybody who walked past. And these are in the tourist districts in the French Quarter. Local regulations do not allow police to identify people with facial recognition without their knowledge or consent. Oops, they got caught. And so now I think the head of police is putting the program on pause. I think that word was carefully chosen to indicate that they're not canceling the program. And if I understand right, the police are trying to make moves to actually rewrite the laws so that they will then be allowed to surveil people. This is just a terrible idea for us to set a precedent that the government will be able to identify every single citizen who walks anywhere in public. But it gets worse, if that's even possible. Thanks to listener Michael for sending me this pointer from The Guardian. This is dated May 18, 2025. The headline is, this is from Australia, New South Wales Education Department caught unaware after Microsoft Teams began collecting students' biometric data. And so what happened here is that Microsoft began using the Teams video conferencing. And the Teams, I think, is Microsoft's version of Zoom. If you've never been so lucky as to use Teams, that's what it is. And some students are just forced to use this Microsoft surveillance software called Teams. And Microsoft unilaterally began more intense surveillance of everyone who uses that installation. This is what The Guardian says. Late last year, Microsoft announced it would enable data collection by default, commencing in March 2025, for a Teams feature known as voice and face enrollment. And that includes recognizing their voice and face. So that's voice surveillance and facial recognition that was turned on by default. I think the story indicated that the administrators there in New South Wales were unaware of that. Maybe they didn't read every little email that came from Microsoft. And so they were surprised, and I suppose rather horrified, when it finally came out that Microsoft was using voice and facial rec on all of their students without their knowledge or consent. So my point here, friends, is that it's both governments that are pushing to get more facial recognition, and of course, the big tech companies, which, as Chris Gilliard said, are all about collecting data from us without our knowledge or consent in as intense a fashion as possible, are continuing to push the limits for how and where and how intrusively they can collect our data in every possible situation. So that's what we face. You know, and again, we need labor, we need legislation, we need more educated consumers to make better choices. We need all of those in order for us to have a united front to fight back against these government and law enforcement agencies and these companies that are trying to destroy the public sphere for their own purposes. And I hope that this show has given you some food for thought to think about what role you might like to play in that process. Again, if you want more information on the show, go to tectonic.fm, T-E-C-H, tonic.fm. You are listening to the greatest radio station in the world, WFMU East Orange, WMFU Mount Hope, in New York City and Rockland County, 91.9 FM, and online at WFMU.org. And stay tuned for my friend Dave Mandel, who's coming on with It's Complicated. Until next time, friends, I do have some homework for you. I want you to avoid Apple, abandon Amazon, forget Facebook, and whatever you do, get off Google. And for our outro, I've got a song called Demolition by Marie Davidson, which, according to the artist, is strongly influenced by the work of professor and sociologist Shoshana Zuboff, who, of course, is a past Tectonic guest and is the author of the now classic book, The Age of Surveillance Capitalism. Very, very pertinent to today's show. And in this song, Demolition, Davidson, quote, adopts the voice of the surveillance capitalists. I thought you would enjoy this. Have a great week, everybody, and I'll see you next time. Extraction. Rendition. Domination. Demolition.
And that gentle sound means it's time for another installment of It's Complicated, an hour of Prague and Prague-adjacent music hosted by me, Dave Mandel. I'm here every Monday at 7 p.m. here at FMU following Tectonic and Mark Hurst. We're going to start tonight's show with something I discovered oddly recent. What? I discovered this only recently. Okay, that made a little more sense. It's a group called Mana Mirage, Mana/Mirage. And I came across this, I don't know, a couple months ago, and was struck by the band name jumped out at me because Mana Mirage was the title of an album by a group called The Muffins, a great proggy group, post-prog group, whatever, based in Maryland, United States. And digging a little deeper, like, you know, a paragraph deeper, I found that the band is actually led by Dave Newhouse. Dave Newhouse was a member, in fact, of the band The Muffins. So it all makes sense. Dave Newhouse's post-Muffins band, and this is post-post, it's actually pretty recent, Mana Mirage, the title of a Muffins album. And it's what we have here is an album called Rest of the World. It was released in 2022. And we're going to hear a track from it right now called Catawampus. This is the group Mana Mirage.